So this is likely going to take us into next week. I don't think I can do this that quickly, but we'll see. It's a preface to Perek Tedvav, and it's a necessary preface because we are going to see in this chapter the war with Amalek, in which, well, take a look quickly at the beginning of the Perek. Right, take a look at chapter 15, sentence 2. Chapter 15, sentence 2. This is what Shmuel is going to say to Shaul. He says, I remember what Amalek did to Israel. They laid a trap for the Jews when they came out of Egypt, right? That was the first time that we were ever attacked, was by Amalek. Now, go strike Amalek. Destroy everything he has. Have no mercy. Ve'emata, and you shall kill. Me'ish adisha, man and woman. Me'olel va'adionek, the very youngest, the nurslings, the infants. Mishor ve'ad seh, ox to sheep. Migamal ve'ad chamor, from camel to donkey. Everything. And Shaul is in fact going to be punished when he spares Agag, the leader of Amalek, and when he spares some of the animals. So, in order to learn this, we have to look at the morality of destroying non-combatants, especially because they're going to be responsible for not having done so. So I've given shiurim on elements of this before, and I don't want to rehash hours and hours on the issue of war and how we look at it, but at the same time, I feel like some discussion about how Judaism views war, and some discussion about Amalek is in order. So if you look at the sheet, the top of the sheet, I gave you links. One link is for a mini-series I did at Beth Emeth on war in Judaism, where we dealt with a lot of these issues, and the other is from a Parsha Shir that I gave last year on Beshalach, where I talked about Amalek. I'm going to be taking elements of that here. I also had a shiur that I gave on Shavuos, so Navarin Lichtenstein, on civilian death and war, but it was on Shavuos, so there's no recording. But in general, as a principle, we try to avoid what I called on the sheet in the heading there, inverted morality. Inverted morality is a sociological phrase, and what it means is that the definition of morality for a soldier is the opposite of the definition of morality in society. Moral behavior in society is you have to be kind, take care of people, certainly never harm anyone, certainly never take someone else's property. You want to be destructive. And if you do that, if your army does that, granted we have principles of Tohar HaNeshek, right? We have the principles for the IDF of following the pure weapons, so to speak. It means that you don't harm unnecessarily, and so on. At the end of the day, the definition of a successful soldier includes somebody who is aggressive, somebody who kills, and somebody who destroys property. There's no way around that. And so the danger, which unfortunately society has seen, is number one, that people go off to war and are guilty of excess during war, because this is the personality that they've taken on. And number two, the challenge of readjusting to society afterwards. When people come back, and now, all the rules are different from what they had. When people come back from war.
The soldier.
Yes. They, so.
The interesting thing is that up until, I think, the First World War, most of the battles that have been fought were on battlefields.
Yeah.
Where soldiers were fighting soldiers, and the average civilian on either side was not necessarily affected.
So I talk about that at one point here. We will get to that point. You're correct, but we will get to that. The God willing, the war. First of all, you have to keep in mind when we enter Canaan is presented not as a way to acquire land, but as a way to evict the Canaanites for their sins. And the way that it's presented is that we are not the reason for the destruction of the Canaanites. Rather, God says, And this, yes, this is judgmental. Yes, this isn't going to fit 20th century, 21st century popular thought. But the idea is that God says, I have a definition for a society that I think is worth existing. You have to not worship idols. You have to not kill. You have to not steal. The Mrs. Menoach, the Noahide laws. I've given them generations to live up to that standard. They have failed to live up to that standard. I'm kicking them out of the land, no matter who you are and what you do. If the Jews don't come in, so I'm going to get rid of the Canaanites anyway. I have chosen you, descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, to whom I promised the land, so Shkoach, you get to go in and do it. But it's not what's supposed to happen. And we've talked about this on other occasions. It's an idea that Rav Kook expresses in what I brought you in number one. The goal was for us to be religious role models. The goal was that they should see our connection with God and say, huh, we want that, and become Ger Toshav, that they should accept the Noahide laws. We didn't live up to that. We created the golden calf, and from there, unfortunately, it was downhill. And so we ended up fighting wars against them instead. But war ends up being a necessity in order to fulfill God's mission, as opposed to a land grab.
Why does God keep giving us chances and he didn't give them that chance?
So he gave them lots of chances to begin with. That's important to note. It's not like they have no chances. They are there from Noah's time for 10 generations plus another 4. So 14 generations is not nothing.
The Canaanites?
The Canaanites, correct.
Yeah, David there.
That's number one. Number two, we are told numerous times, both as a prediction in the Chumash and then by the prophets later on, that the only reason we're still hanging on is because they bris the covenant that Hashem made with our ancestors. So, you know, there's a contract. God's going to live up to it. However, I wonder if you matched it up, though. If you matched up the number of years from the time of Canaan, son of Noah, and whenever it is that his descendants spread out in the land, until their eviction at our hands, or partial eviction at our hands, and you compare that with the length of time from when we come in from the wilderness until we are exiled by Nebuchadnezzar or later on by the Romans, I wonder how those years stack up. I haven't done the math. I'm curious about that.
Did you do the math?
Yeah, the numbers are there. I mean, we know that the only thing I'm not sure about is, I think from the Mabul until Avraham is not that long. I think you're talking about a few, it's 10 generations, but they're already having children in their 30s at that point.
Yeah, but so, the generation isn't it 33 years?
It's not about that. It's the begats. So if this one was 34 when he had children, then 34 years, and then another one was 30, and then it's another 30 years, and so on. It's only a couple of centuries, you know. But I don't know the precise number from the Mabul until Abraham. That's what I'm not sure of in order to be able to do it. So that's a great discussion for another time. I'm not going into that right now. No, it's a good discussion. It's just not for right now. But the bottom line is it will be an interesting calculation. I'm missing that number. That's what I'm not sure about. So the Torah is very concerned about what Jews are going to look like if they're going to go to war and engage in this kind of behavior, and therefore it gives all sorts of instructions, which I brought you here on the sheet, to try to help us avoid the impact of inverted morality. So first of all, in source number 2, we are told, when you draw near to a city to fight it, you are required to sue for peace first. According to the Rambam, that applies even with Mechames Mitzvah, even where it's a war that God has commanded you to engage in. Rashi disagrees, but that's the Rambam's position. That's number 1. Number 2, we have all sorts of laws that are introduced to us in source number 3, when we are told, when you go out to war, v'nishmartami kol davara, stay away from all things that are bad, from bad conduct. And Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch comments on that. I brought him here in number 6. Also, when you leave the normal boundaries of family and civil life, and you are in a military camp arranged against your enemies, then even though you are in a military camp, where the ethical reins are easily loosened, and the actual goal of war is an unrestrained coarseness, then too, guard yourself against every bad thing. Do not cease examining yourself with self-control. Be on guard against, quote, every bad thing. You have to find a way to maintain Kedusha, to maintain holiness. And so, you know, we're told in number four, I'm not sure why I placed it the way I did, but in number four we are told that, I see what I did. All right, it's okay. And the four and five we didn't really need yet, that's why. But in number four we are told that raising your sword upon the Mizbeach, upon the altar, is a desecration for the altar. The war has to be recognized as separate from that which is holy. We have commands about not destroying the trees. You have to remember the point of your siege is not to destroy the society, but not to destroy the trees in the city. And there's much more along these lines. If you go to the link for the series that I did at Beth Emeth, that's really where I talked about it at much greater length. When it comes to non-combatants, right, and you're talking here about the women and the children in the war with Amalek, so we have biblical precedent on both sides. You have biblical precedent for harming innocents, and you have biblical precedent for sparing innocents. On the one hand, Shimon and Levi wipe out all of Shechem, which of course Yaakov criticizes. It depends on how you read the pasuk. On the other hand, when Shaul goes to war here, he warns the Cani who are living among Amalek. He says, "Get out of the way. I don't want you to get hurt in this war." The Gemara presents a fascinating limit on the rights of an invading army. If you take a look at source number 9, the things that I had here, in number 7, it was about not destroying the trees. Number 8 was that we want the leader of the Jewish people. Moshe here is going to appoint a new leader for the Jews. And he wants a leader who's going to travel with the nation and fight with the nation, so he'll see the way that they are behaving, the way that they conduct themselves. But in terms of this, the Gemara on harming the enemy, the Gemara in Shavuot says, "Malchusa dekatla chad mishisa ba'alma lo me'ansha." A government which would kill up to 1/6 of the world would not be punished. Meaning, you're allowed to kill up to 1/6 of the global population. This comes up in discussions about the ethics of nuclear war in Judaism. And Tosfos says that's a limit from a Chemes HaRishus. That's only if you're dealing with a discretionary war, not with a mitzvah war. A mitzvah war could be more than 1/6. I just found that to be very interesting, the idea that you have some kind of a cap, and the question, of course, is where do you end up with that number? Like, how did that, where does that come from? But you recognize here that there is a possibility recognized of the death of non-combatants, and three justifications are offered for this. Justification number one, you'll be familiar with from the story with Shechem, which is that in the event that the city does not set up a just and fair government that protects the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the Noachai laws, then they will be vulnerable to attack because they are responsible for not having set up a proper society. The argument is made in Shechem, where the prince of the city kidnaps and rapes a woman and and the city goes along with it. And frankly, the argument is made in our own day, right? The argument I don't mean to now enter into a discussion of Israel and Arabs and so on, so don't take this as carte blanche for us to have that discussion. But I will note, the defense is the same as saying that the people of Gaza are responsible because they elected Hamas and they support Hamas, and therefore, whatever happens, happens. That's not the government stance, that's not the IDF stance, but I've heard that argument made. It's the same argument as the argument about Shechem, that if they're going to have a leadership like this, then they are responsible for the consequences. Rav Shaul Yisraeli did not like that idea. If you take a look at Rav Shaul Yisraeli in source number 11, this is my translation of his Amud HaYamini, Number 10 is the Rambam's statement that in Shechem they're responsible for the acts of their leadership. But in number 11, Rabbi Yisraeli says there are insufficient grounds to permit action against a community that refuses to fulfill its obligation and eliminate murderers from their midst, so long as they may have the excuse of fear, pressure, and the like. He says if the reason why the population didn't act against their leadership is because they'd get killed if they acted against their leadership, then it's not right to hold them responsible militarily. But that's one argument, is civilians are responsible for the actions of the society in which they live. Second argument is, this is the nature of a war of self-defense. This is what happens. When you're fighting a war, then recognize that civilians are going to get harmed because of the nature of war in our day, and frankly even before our day, despite the difference about there being front lines in the old times and not now, which we're going to talk about. I'm not there yet. But the Maharal makes that argument. Maharal, in source number 12, quotes the verse which says that you're supposed to sue for peace, v'karasa eleha l'shalom, and he says, that is where they have not acted upon Israel. Where they have acted towards Israel, they've attacked us, and he gives you Shechem as the example where they took Dina, then even though only one of them had done it, since they attacked first, Israel was permitted to respond, and so too for all wars. Since there were those among the nation who had harmed them, they were permitted to go to war against them, and this is the nature of war. That's your second defense. And then the third is sometimes you need to do this in order to defend our soldiers. Not the same argument as the second one. The second one is, look, if you're permitting war, you know civilians are going to get hurt.
But they were not willing to become like us.
Don't kid yourself.
How do we know that?
Because of what they said. They said, if we circumcise ourselves, then they will marry back and forth and they'll do business with us. That's not about becoming in any way, shape, or form students of...
To go through that kind of thing. And circumcise each other all the way
through. There is no mention whatsoever of accepting the ideology of this family. That's not even a discussion.
They want them to marry them.
That's what they want.
They didn't want war with them.
No, that's true.
I cannot justify you, though. I am sorry. I can't.
I didn't ask you to. But the second argument is that if you're permitting war, recognize this is part of war. And then the third argument is that sometimes you need to do this in order to defend your own soldiers. Meaning, and this was a big discussion in Lebanon, this is an issue in Jenin and so forth, that if you're not willing to accept that civilians are going to die, you're going to end up having your own soldiers die trying to get around it. Rav Avram Shapiro was very big on this, and if there's an essay... It was actually written, I think, by his son-in-law in the journal Tchumen, in source number 13. He says, where there is no substantive risk to our soldiers, there is no permission to strike lives or property. However, when there is a discernible risk, one must remember that it is not only a matter of weighing one unit opposite a civilian population on the scale. In other words, don't say, well, it's about 5 soldiers on our side or 100 people on the other side. I guess protect the 100. He says, no, the loss of one unit or part of it can affect the entire battle. So his argument, Rav Shapiro's argument, was don't look after their civilians. That's not your concern. And frankly, Shaul supports that. Because what does Shaul say to the Kehni? He says to the Kehni, I want you to move out of the way so you don't get hurt.
Right.
But if you don't move out of the way, then what's going to happen? It's your problem. So he does accept that. But Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was very against. And that's what I brought you here in number 14.
I like it.
He says, the beginning of the calculation of a war's justification is the concept of Mechemet Mitzvah. The category of Mechemet Mitzvah, a war that is a command to do, includes war to help Israel before an enemy who attacks. That's the language of the Rambam. It has to be a war that is to help Israel. The phrase is the aid of Israel. We must ask whether a particular war will actually help Israel. Not every war aids Israel. Meaning, you can't think...
War in Israel.
Mm-hmm. His point is to say that you can't make the mistake of thinking that every military action even if it saves our lives, is of aid for Israel as a whole. Sometimes you may save lives, in terms of saving our lives, and yet it comes at a very high price. Take a look at what he says. He says, first, it demands sacrifices from us. As Menachas Chinuch says, one can't depend on miracles in war. There is always a concern for the loss of Israeli fighters. When you go into a war, you have to recognize you're going to lose people. And he says, therefore, you don't necessarily want to go into a war. That's number one. Number two, the price of war is also paid by the enemy, who is also graced with a divine image, and one should grieve whenever God's creations drown in the sea. On this point, the issue of quantity is meaningful, and one certainly must weigh the justifications for harming many in order to save an individual. The calculation that Rav Shapiro does not like, to say, well, don't tell me it's about five of us versus 100 of them. Rav Aaron says, no, it is. It is about five of us versus 100 of them. And then third, he says, war harms the nature of the individual and society which battle. As Ramban wrote regarding that pasuk, you shall be on guard against every bad thing. The most naturally righteous of people will be clothed with cruelty and rage when going to war against the enemy, and therefore the verse warned, and so on, and David can't build the Beis HaMikdash. He says, you have to consider the effect of making us cruel as part of your calculation. So that's all within his first part. And then his second part. He says, the second problem we've identified is how to run the war, even if it is justified. Excuse me. In our days, and this goes back to what was said before, war has become total war. It no longer distinguishes, as it did in medieval times, between the front and behind the lines. Therefore, it is difficult to distinguish between the civilian population and the fighting force. Therefore, it is even harder to provide a precise prescription for each circumstance. However, it is most important that one who is going to war know that he is not transitioning from a world of one hierarchy of values to a world of a different hierarchy of values. One man and one nation cannot split in two. In every case, peace must stand at the height of the hierarchy of values. As Rashi wrote to Vayikra, peace is equal to all. That's where he leaves it. He's very reticent about this idea of harming a civilian population. So I bring you all of this as background, because that's exactly what we're going to see here with Amalek. The other thing that we have to see, which we're not going to do clearly this time, I think, it's hard because I started a new recording, so I'm not sure what time it is. 2:28 is my answer. What we still have to talk about is this mitzvah of war with Amalek across generations. So that's what we'll do as an introduction next time, before seeing what actually happened in the war of Shaul with Amalek. Okay? Thank you.